Hello and welcome to Sobriety Chat. I am your host, Lotta Dan, otherwise known as Mrs. D. I am the community manager and content creator here at Living Sober. And today, this is exciting. I am joined by the wonderful Mandy Manners, who is one half of the Love Sober team. We'll talk about that in a minute. But Mandy herself is, well, she's an author. She's a recovery coach. She's a podcaster. She's a partner. She's a friend. She's a mother. And she is sober. Welcome, Mandy.
Hi, thanks for having me.
Oh, so good to see you. Now, you're in France. What time is it there?
Is 9:30 in the morning. Yeah.
Okay, that's not too bad.
Exactly 12 hours apart.
Yep, 9:30 in the evening here in New Zealand. And tell me, how are you going today? I'll just sort of start with a right here, right now. What have you been doing to get yourself on this chair talking to me this morning?
Yeah, I'm good, thank you. It's the second week of school holidays here in France. So we were skiing last week. That was the first time I've ever been skiing, which was terrifying. Really kind of pushed me into a fear space I hadn't been to in a
Is that
long time.
right?
Yeah, I had actually had a panic attack on the mountainside. Because someone kind of collided into me, and then someone collided into them, and then they collided, and I think it was because it was out of my control. So I was really fearful anyway, and then all of a sudden something happened that was out of my control, and I just went into kind of fight, flight, freeze. So anyway, I don't know whether I'll be skiing again, but I did go back the next day, so I'm really proud. I kind of
And
put
went
my,
back on your skis.
yeah, I did.
Oh, good on you.
And did the rest of the week. So yeah, I'm good. The kids are just getting up. They've got kind of a quiet week this week. My kids are older now. My daughter's 15, my son's 13, so I'm kind of out of that. Very
Hardcore
different.
parenting.
Yeah.
So how old were they when you quit drinking? How long have you been sober for now?
I like to say that I've been on the journey for over 8 years because I think it's important to sort of honor and value the time before you actually secured it. So I kind of first joined a sober forum back in 2013. And so I went back and forward for a little bit. And then I finally quit for a year. And then we moved house, loads of different things happened, and I started drinking again. I did that classic, oh, I can moderate now. I'm sure I'll be fine type thing. And kind of went back and forth for about another 2 years. So I actually finally quit. My sober date is 17th August 2017. So that's like 4.5 years now.
What was it like building up to that second point where you did sort of quit for good? Because I hear from a lot of people that it's almost, I don't know what, like harder when you're doing it again after a kind of relapse, because all the freshness and newness and sparkly-eyed sobriety stuff isn't there because you've done it before. And so it's a bit, I don't know, tell me, what's it like? I was a once and done person, right? I just, and I know that's not how it goes for a lot of people. So yeah, I'm interested to hear.
And I do think it's really important to talk about that stuff, because it's a very different it was a very different journey for me. As you say, the first time, there was that brightness, that newness, but also a lot of willpower. It was just like I was getting away from a problem. So it was very much led by, I was in burnout from work, I had depression, serious anxiety, kind of realized that alcohol wasn't happening. So it was very much led by my mental health, and that took me so far. We always talk about the toolkit and kind of self-care, but and none of that had I on board at that point. So, I was kind of running with it. And it was amazing that first year. I quit my job, we moved to the seaside, I ran a half marathon, it was all of those sort of things.
God.
I
That's a lot in a year.
know. I tend to, well, the addiction brain tends to be quite, all or nothing about things. And then when we moved, I kind of well, it was the fact of kind of A, I'd stopped working, so I didn't really know what I was doing. B, we're in a new place, kind of making friends. It was just like, I didn't have the toolkit. I didn't have the sort of capacity, resilience to approach that sober. So, you know, and living in France, where so much of it is around kind of wine culture. You know, we arrived, we met some people. They were very much, used to be a sommelier. So I just was like, I can't do this. But there was very much, I think, in my head, an unconscious kind of sort of thing that if I got to a year, I didn't have a problem. And I only, because it took a long time to sort of unpack what happened. You know, I did a year, and why did I go back? And I do think there was that kind of unconscious thing of like, if I do a year, then I don't have a problem. So then it was like, okay, because I've done a year.
So I proved to myself that I can control this.
Yeah.
And now I'm going to go back to it.
And I do think a lot of people, you know, that's like things like Dry January and Sober October are great. They really are. But I do think there's quite a lot of people that might be going into it like that. And it's like, right, if I prove myself I can do a month, then I don't have a problem. But actually, they're not changing their behavior at all. Or, you know, they're always ending up in the same place.
Yeah, I know. I've got people very close to me who do like a month a year, and it's almost like, see, I'm in control. I always have that month off, but it's a white knuckling month. It's like hanging on for dear life and then fantasizing and planning about what, that's what I used to do, and plan about what I was going to have at the end of it.
Yeah, so I think that's kind of what I did for a year, you know. I mean, I didn't, because there was a lot of good growth in that point, but there was quite a lot of kind of just sort of willpower within there. So the second time round, like, so it was always still around my mental health, you know. So I got very depressed again, and I got, you know, in the end, I sort of, because of kind of past trauma, I wasn't sleeping at all. So I ended up sort of getting, sort of had to go and see a psychiatrist and was put on some sort of antipsychotic medication, you know. So I was at home, but I wasn't well at all. So then I quit again, you know, so it was always around that kind of thing. And I kind of had this deal around, you know, if I wake up at 4 o'clock in the morning again, that's it, you know, I quit. So I just had this kind of circular thing going around, but I didn't have the kind of, I hadn't built me as a sober person. Like, I hadn't understood how I can make it long term. And I hadn't forgiven myself for a lot of things. So I think that period in between, you know, people really beat themselves up, and it's not great. Like, I don't want people to, you know, the best thing is to stop and never drink again, because your neural pathways and your brain cut off, and, you know, it's like smoking, right? It's like, as soon as you pick up a cigarette, you remember again. But that period was part of my journey, because I needed to do that forgiveness work, self-compassion work. I went back to therapy, you know, I owned my trauma, you know, and talked about it. And, you know, I hadn't spoken about it to me for over 15 years. So all of that stuff had to happen. And also, you know, for me, a big thing was, kind of my personal self. Like, I'd always been a rebel. I'd always been, you know, a hedonist, being raving and festivals and all of that stuff. And I couldn't see me in my sobriety.
Yeah.
Realize that actually,
where's that fun party girl,
most rebellious thing I could do,
I know.
And then it was like, okay, you know, I can do this, I can get tattoos and be rebellious, you know, and tell everyone, like, all of that stuff. And it, when I had that moment, when I had that click of actually this is a really kind of brave, rebellious choice, then it became me, and it wasn't like something I was taking out anymore, it was something that I was like getting.
Yeah. Isn't that the ultimate irony? I've actually got a chapter in my last book called The Ultimate Rebellion. When I started drinking, I partly did it because I did feel so naughty and rebellious, but actually I was just conforming hugely to what everyone else was doing. And actually turning around in this world of ours and going, I'm not going to touch that stuff anymore, is hugely rebellious. Yeah. And I'm like you, once I tapped into that feeling of being really quite countercultural, that appealed to the little naughty girl inside me. Yeah. You know, every time I go to a bar and I order a chamomile tea, I'm basically going, drinking culture.
Exactly. And I think that's when, like, when you know, why community is so important, because it's like when you actually start to go into sober spaces and talk to people, it was like, oh, you're not the boring people. You're the people that had too much fun. You know?
Yeah, right, exactly. So but like, I just want to go back.
We don't need that, you know. So
talking about sharing, I just want to go back because, I mean, I sort of know you as much as I can, given we're on opposite side of the world. You know, I've been on your podcast. I follow you on social media. And I know that you are very comfortable talking about your mental health and your past trauma and what have you. But, you know, some people watching this might be like, whoa, she's up front. There's still a lot of holding back of that stuff. So you kind of always been like, what did it take for you to get to the point where you can sit so comfortably and just throw it out there as part of your narrative and not hold any, I don't know, whether it's shame or at least, I don't know, what is it about that you're so open about that now?
Yeah, it's a really good question. And it took a really long time. I think with trauma recovery, I think it's very much a sort of a journey that of growth, you know, little bits open, little by little, you know, and it is that kind of chain reaction of like, once you tell someone and you have it confirmed and you have it fed back to you that it's not your fault, you know, then you can grow from that point and you can kind of open up. And I do think it's also about kind of being inspired by others, you know. So a key thing for me is I read Mad Girl by Bryony Gordon, which was all around her mental health story. And that was one of the pinnacle moments of me really quitting forever, because it was like, okay, this is, I have depression. Like, I have depression, you know, I get anxious. I take medication, that there's nothing to be ashamed about. That's just me, you know. And when I could, and then it was just like, oh, my poor brain, like my poor brain is quite fragile, you know. And so if I'm putting alcohol into my brain, then I'm hurting something that's already quite fragile. Mm. It was like when I sort of understood trauma, you know, and trauma is so, you know, I was raped and violently sort of attacked when I was 18, when I was traveling in Mexico. And as I said before, I didn't tell anyone. I, you know, kept it a secret for over 15 years. And I was full of shame, you know, it was because it was me, because I drank too much, because I was, you know, that kind of naughty girl that kind of annoyed the kind of local men or whatever. So I kept it all in. And then I went to She Recovers. I went to in Los Angeles, and they had a shame booth. So it was like this little kind of, it was like a confessional booth, really.
Oh, wow.
And it was an art installation. You went inside, you picked up the phone, and you spoke your shame. It's by an amazing kind of visual artist. And it was by doing that and then also being in a room with women that were talking about the most incredible kind of painful subjects.
So hang on, did you go in that booth and talk in the phone about what had happened and you hadn't done that before?
And that was the moment, because I'd never told my parents, I'd never told anyone. So I told my parents for probably another year, but it was that moment of like being able to say it out loud and also to say that I was ashamed of it. You know, I'm ashamed because, you know, I drank too much, because I did this and this led me to this happening. And then hearing that out loud was like, you know, really, Mandy, really, like kind of thing. And then I could talk about therapy and then that kind of, And so my kind of, you know, so I'm a trauma-informed coach, so I've done quite a lot of work around that, and obviously that's something that, you know, is so, so key in so many people's drinking story.
Yeah.
Then I understood that the poor brain again, you know, if you've had trauma, then that part of your brain, which is where, you know, the prefrontal cortex, where you make good decisions, that's, you know, had a bit of a bash, as has it if it's got depression or anxiety. So it was just like all of these part, you know, it's like, okay, you know, what can I do to help myself? Like, I deserve that. And if you take out alcohol, you know, it's like, that's the, when we talk about self-care, that's my anchor, that's the baseline, that's the 100%. Me being sober is the best part of my self-care toolkit, you know.
Same. So I wanted to ask you about, I wanted to ask you about being a trauma-informed coach, because there is a movement in the recovery world and the addiction sector and here in New Zealand as well for people who work trying to help people with addictions to become more trauma-informed. What does that mean exactly, and how does it look when you're coaching people when you come with that sort of approach?
Well, it's essentially the understanding that you know, trauma, again, it's not like addictions. Addictions aren't black and white. Trauma is a spectrum as well. You know, essentially, it's your nervous system being dysregulated. So that could be from chronic stress. That could be from, you know, a shock trauma like I had. That could be from, you know, dysfunctional family relationships when you didn't feel safe as a child. Could be bullying, racism, you know, homophobia, the impact of life on us. All of that impact on our nervous system, which means that we are often in fight, flight, freeze, you know, in a sort of trauma state. And a lot of us use drugs and alcohol as a way to self-soothe and to bring our nervous system, you know, to a sort of a point which feels comfortable enough to function. So it's essentially working with that as an informed way. So knowing that that might be part of someone's story, and knowing that working with the nervous system is probably going to be something that will be helpful. So finding other ways to relax, finding ways to get into flow through, you know, creativity or writing, you know, finding ways to like calm their breathing, knowing probably that their triggers are due to stress. Stress is a bucket. So the more things you load into it, the less resilience we have, essentially.
Do you sometimes touch in on stuff, though, that is so sort of big and scary that it's almost like, what do I do with this? You know, like, it's sometimes big.
It's really scary. But like, I mean, I'm not a therapist. So there'll be that moment if someone is kind of talking about their past experience, there'll be that moment of like, you know, this is not coaching. Let's find you, you know, therapeutic support to actually deal with the trauma. Whereas for me, it's like working with the understanding when they come in the room that, you know, they probably have, you know, a story, and it's not leading them with questions. It's making sure that they're very, you know, comfortable, that they take the lead, that I don't, you know. The idea of being powerless, all of those things can be very complex for someone who has had trauma. So it's really about empowering them. Like, what do you want to do? What does it feel like to you? You know, what label would you like to talk about with the situation? Rather than saying, you know, sort of giving someone a diagnosis, it's about them owning their own, you know, for the first time in life, perhaps being able to have self-leadership.
How much does this work in helping others help you as well now, Mandy? I mean, look at the space you're in. It's amazing. It's so great what you do in helping other people, women especially. But I'm sure you've got a lot of male readers of your book and listeners of your podcast. Yeah. But how does that in turn help you in your recovery?
Oh, hugely. Because, and again, that's another one of the reasons why I'm so open on kind of social media is that, you know, a lot of people that come to me are in therapeutic professions. You know, there is a lot of doctors, a lot of nurses, a lot of mums, a lot of people that are in caring professions that are struggling with drugs and alcohol. And I'm open about myself. You know, let's change the conversation. It's like everyone is allowed to be vulnerable, even those that help, you know. You can still have, it's not binary, like you can have anxiety and be an amazing doctor, you know, but you need looking after too. I mean, hugely kind of, it keeps me sober.
That's the same with me. That's my secret trick, all this work I do. It's all very helpful to others, but really it's helping me so that I never go back to that place.
No, and I think, and also, I mean, that's part of kind of, if you look at the science of happiness, which is a lot of the work that Kate and I put into our courses, you know, things like gratitude practices, things like awe and wonder, flow, all of those things that help you to kind of, one of those is purpose. You know, if you're not aligned with your values, if you're not working in a place day to day, or living, you know, in alignment with what matters most to you, then that's taking away from your self-esteem and your self-worth and your happiness. So being able to see people progress and you know, and find the things that they love in sobriety, you know, it's not, for me, it's not about getting them sober, it's about the next bit. It's like, you know, when you see they've learned paddleboard, or that they've, you know, they've or, you know, like they just kind of, or not even, or just the little things, or the fact that they've grown vegetables in their garden or whatever, you know.
Or they left that partner that was really not good for them. Or we've had long-time members of Living Sober who have discovered pottery, you know, which is so cliched, but she's making these amazing figurines of people's dogs to custom figurines of, we've got a custom figurine of our dog Stanley, you know, made by her, and I just know that she's blossomed. And yes, as you say, it could be the small things, but it's such a wonderful gift to watch people lift up, especially when they're grinding through. And I said to you before we started recording this, a lot of our members are grinding through those early weeks. I wanted to ask you, so you have a lot of people come to you with your coaching, your courses and what have you. Are some of them still drinking? And if so, what are the biggest sort of barriers you find for them to stop, and how do you help them get over that hump to actually just try abstinence?
Yeah. Yeah. I mean, we have a mixture for sure. And people that are, I mean, we have people in the community that are, you know, are, can maybe do 3 weeks and then they'll have a blip, or we'll have people that are still, sober curious, as it were, and just, you know, anyone's welcome, because if you're questioning your drinking, that's the first step. Those early days, I mean, I think we were talking about this yesterday, Kate and I, there's this kind of beautiful process where at the beginning it's very much about kind of locking down. So it's like building that sober bubble, you know, it's saying no to things, it's keeping things really small, it's about, you know, routine. It's about stress reduction, you know. So for me at the beginning, you know, I worked out that, because my kids were what, you know, 4 or 5 when I first quit that first time. So, and I was working full time as a professor in a university, so hugely stressed kind of time, and living abroad. And so I worked out that what I was doing was, I wasn't eating because I was constantly, you know, on a diet. I didn't get undressed from my work clothes, so I was still in my heels, you know. I'd feed the kids, put them in the bath, and then I'd sink on the same chair every night and open a bottle of wine and maybe have some chocolate, because, you know, eating, you know, why would you do that kind of thing? And so,
well, because it works in the moment, it does what we want. We're supposed to deny that.
So me at the beginning, it was very much that I realized, right, when I come in, you know, I have a snack with the kids, eat, drink a glass of water, you know, then go and get changed. Then I would put the kids in the bath. When the kids got out of the bath, I'd run the bath again really hot, so I'd have enough time to like read them a story, put them to bed, because my husband worked away, so it was always me. And then I'd just go straight in the bath. And I'd listen to Radio 4, BBC Radio 4, or something that felt really nourishing to the brain. And this wasn't very conscious at the time, but it was just what I got into that routine. But I realise now that, you know, going and sitting back on that chair was, you know, a massive trigger. You know, watching the TV in that chair, all of that, because your brain just goes into autopilot. So the more you disrupt the system from what you used to do, the better. So it's like,
great advice.
Yeah,
I've not heard that one much, actually. So just changing those simple things. You can't change the fact you have to cook dinner every night, but maybe, I don't know, you do it in a different
way. Eat with the kids, eat early, you know. Yeah. So part of it is, with your stress, is your blood sugar levels are going down because you've got loads of cortisol in the system. So make sure you eat, make sure you drink water, and then just cut the ritual, cut the routine. So I would just go in the bath every night and I'd lie there, and just that was like, okay, like, you know, I'm doing something for me. I'm doing something. And I don't know, so now we have podcasts. That time we didn't have podcasts, but I used to listen to the news or listen to like a radio play, and it was like, wow, like I would never have done this if I was drinking. and all these little information. And then I just go straight to bed. And I did that for about 6 weeks or something.
Yeah, early to bed. Gosh, yeah. Meeting Kate was one of those, must have been one of those special sparkly moments. I often wonder about the two of you because you work so closely together and you do such great work and you both really complement each other from what I can see from the other side of the world. You complement each other really well. But I'm really interested to hear what that's like, the two of you collaborating on all this work that you do and how it goes over time.
Yeah, I mean, it was really by chance. Like, we met on a sober forum, we met on Soberistas, you know, anonymously. And she used to be a journalist, she's a brilliant writer. So I kind of followed her blogs and then kind of, you know, she went to see Kay Tempest. And I was like, ooh, maybe she can be my friend kind of thing. So I stalked her basically for a little bit. And then we were chatting online and I had an idea to do a podcast because I'd been listening to a lot of the ones in the States and they were brilliant, but they didn't address British culture, which is quite different with drinking. So
it
I just,
really is.
She was training to be a coach and said, do you want to do a podcast with me? And she was like, yeah, sure, kind of thing. Neither of us knew how to do it. Luckily, an old friend of mine was a music producer, so he helped us right at the beginning to like gave us a little bit of music and gave us kind of edited it. And she was working on a book proposal, so she was like, oh, do you want to? I'd actually really like to collaborate on this book with someone. So that's how it started, really, and it was really organic. And then I was still teaching at that time, but I'd been considering coaching, and then I went to LA to She Recovers, and then I was like, right, I definitely want to be a recovery coach. So I retrained, sometimes it can be tricky because we both got families, we both got different, you know, financial pressures, and so that can be quite complicated sometimes just to try and meet each other's needs as well as our own. We're two women in recovery, so we're you know,
emotional as fuck.
Got those moments of like, do you love me? Oh no, oh, I love you too much. I don't know how to manage all this sort of feelings. But yeah, you know, it's been great for both of us, and it really kind of part of that is all part of our story. You know, it's part of those conversations.
And you do one podcast a week, don't you? And you've just kept that up for how long now?
It's been going for over 3 years, or
amazing.
Yeah, 170 odd podcasts.
Amazing. I highly recommend it. Anyone watching who hasn't listened, and I'll put the link in the blog post where I embed this video, but it is, it's just really good because you just feel like you're with these two lovely women who are chatting and you know, having a nice time, but also being kind and nurturing to one another and talking about the shit that we want to talk about, which is obviously living sober, how to navigate through life, because life keeps happening and it's tricky. And so
I mean, I think that's been not to our great joy, but you know, both Kay and I have had a lot of stuff, you know, over the last 3 years since we've been doing the podcast. You know, we've both had losses, you know, we've lost people we love, you know, we've had family problems with, you know, redundancy, we've had problems with housing, you know, all the things, right? And testament to our sobriety of that actually being the anchor that pulls us through is amazing, really, you know. And we're so grateful, and that's doing the podcast keeps us grateful, you know, because it can be so hard.
I was just gonna, I didn't want to cut you off now. What were you gonna say?
I was just gonna say that, you know, the sober landscape has changed a lot, you know,
hasn't it?
There's so many podcasts now, there's so many great resources, but part of that is there's a few people that are perhaps not as trained as they should be. So that there's a difficult time, I think, in the sober kind of world at the moment of really, like, I mean, we wrote a course for the Coaching Academy around addictive behaviors, which is certified by, you know, one of the biggest training sort of providers in the world, purely because we want really good trained people. Yeah. in the world. And I think that's been quite challenging for us. And I know for you, you know, with books and just trying to hold space in a very, what's the word? Ethical and kind of
safe, I think, way.
Professional and safe way. Mm-hmm. Yeah, so that, I think that will be probably something we've been talking a lot about, is how can we get the profession of coaching, how can we, you know, keep people safe in this space, which is amazing that it's so big now. It's wonderful. But, you know, you've got celebrities coming out as being sober and then, like, you know, 2 months later saying that they'll moderate, and without any understanding of the impact that that's going to happen on people, maybe not that where they are on their addiction spectrum or whatever.
I've noticed that as well.
I feel a little bit like I'm excited, but I'm also conscious of kind of nurturing really kind of professional, well-skilled spaces for people.
That's one of the great things about you too, is that you're so learned. Hey, I'm going to wrap it up soon, but I want to ask you before we leave, because, you know, self-care, and you've mentioned it already, but it is so important. What are your kind of go-tos now? If you're having a bad day, what are the ways that you know how to soothe yourself and look after yourself?
It's like, look, it's like all smiley. It's like, oh, the favourite topic. I had a few negotiations with my husband, because my husband still drinks, so he's a French man with a wine cellar. That's not happening, not changing anytime soon. But we had many conversations around how much he spends on booze, and I told him that I'm having the same amount of money for my own sober treats. So he cut me down by a bit. I was like, no, I'm having the same amount of money. So anyway, so I have a shiatsu massage once a month. She's like a holistic sort of practitioner. So she does a lot around kind of minerals and nutrients. So, you know, we always talk about magnesium and those sort of things. So I do that once a month. I have some noise reduction headphones, which are my favorite thing, because they cut out all the noise of everyone and they're really calming for the nervous system. I still go in the bath. I think, like, I'll have a bath at 10 in the morning. You know, it doesn't have to be in the evening, but if I'm feeling stressed out or sad, that's probably my place where I go for my emotions, really. You know, I'll cry in the bath or I'll listen to music. Music is a big sort of emotional aid for me. It can pick me up, like if I'm down, I'll put on some disco and I'll shake it out and dance, or, you know, if I want to cry it out, I'll put on some music that will help me. Animals, I've got a dog and a cat. What else?
That's a lot of great stuff. And jigsaw puzzles, I know you do occasionally.
Yes, jigsaw puzzle. We moved house, I need a new space for, I haven't got yet.
I've lost my puzzle table.
Yeah.
For my studies that I'm about to do, I've had to turn my puzzle table into a study table. But hey, look, you are wonderful and amazing, and I thank you so much for winging in. I don't know, the videos felt a little bit glitchy, so apologies if it's been glitchy to watch, but I think we've managed all right. And like I say, I'll share all the links, Mandy, to your book and your podcast and your site, and you know, just keep up the great work. And
thanks for inviting me.
Thanks for doing my sobriety chat. Bye.